They say plants like music.
Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From his cell on death row in Florida, confessed serial killer Danny Rowling started writing and illustrating this novel about the Daggerman Sicarius in 1999, 7 years before his 2006 execution for the five murders he committed in 1990. Drawing on years of research, Rowling follows zoologist Sir Winsor Ashmole to the African island of Mauritius to assist Dr. Borgum Konoff in saving endangered species. But the doctor's dabbling in sinister forces, torturing the island's girls in a mad quest for immortality, as an alien relic gives him the superhuman powers of a Sicarius. Caught in the act, Konoff escapes to Boston, where he goes on a murder rampage. Ashmole helps police track him, but the power of the relic is still protecting the elusive Sicarius. As the powers that be close in on the crazed killer, a deal with the forces of darkness is brokered by a witch whose name is Kath, a nod to the woman who served as Rowling's muse in real life, at the time he dreamed up the tale. The novel was published in 2002 by Plot Digger Publications, a corporation owned by Canadian filmmaker Ryan Nicholson, who died in 2019 without renewing the copyright. So the book was orphaned until 2022, when Sandra London gave new life to this tale that Rowling had originally asked her to publish. The book that we're featuring this evening is Sicarius, Sandra London Presents Death Row Fiction by a Serial Killer, with my special guest, journalist and author and true crime author, Sandra London. Welcome to the program and thank you so much for this interview, Sandra London.
Oh, thank you, Dan. You're my favorite podcaster.
Thank you so much, Sandra London. And congratulations on this very, very interesting book. Let's talk about right from the very beginning. You in the introduction call this warnings about free speech, and the new normal calls for warnings on anything that might offend anyone. You write about Sicarius was written by a serial killer on death row. Tell us why free speech is so important, especially in regards to this book.
Okay. Well, I'm a free speech radical. I don't believe in any form of compelled speech or limited speech at all. So that's my personal bias. I've been punished in court, had my life ruined over this issue, so I'm entitled to speak. And I speak about this book in introductory terms specifically because the world has changed so much since Danny Rowling wrote it. And there are forces at work in our culture that are demanding compelled speech and demanding that things not be said, words not be used. And I'm not going to honor any of that. I published this myself because anytime a establishment publisher gets a hold of materials such as I've produced over the years, they really want to censor it. Let's put it that way. And it's not helpful. I think that censoring the thoughts and expressions specifically involving violence, I don't think that it accomplishes what they imagine it should. It doesn't stop violence. Instead, it drives the violent impulse deeper into the darkness. And in the dark side of the personality is where all the powerful drives are that we lose control of. So the more that we are able to deal with things consciously and openly, at least we won't have these shadow impulses coming along from we don't even know where and causing so much trouble. So I think the impulse to censor all expression until it is inoffensive is very wrong. And I think it's very wrong when it comes to violence, because at this point, violence is easy to commit at a distance and without any visceral involvement. And I believe that there's a lot of people who are seduced into committing violence because they don't realize what it means and what it does and what it does to themselves. And so I think if we really listen to people like Danny Rowling, who've been there and done that, there are things that they have learned that we need to learn. We can't learn them, and we're not going to cross that fatal line. We're not going to break the law and become killers. But we would like to know what they learned from the other side. And the way you do that is by communication.
You write about transgressive writing, that criminal behavior is transgressive for involves violating the boundaries of the social contract. Tell us about transgressive fiction.
Well, I'm just giving an official notice that this is the very nature of this document. We are dealing with behavior that crosses boundaries. And so please do not bring in an inappropriate censorship mindset to this book. If you don't like that, then just close that book sooner the better.
Tell us about your first book, Death Row Fiction.
My first book was Knocking on Joe, Voices from Death Row. And I had set out in the zine revolution. Remember in the 80s, I published zines, which were like self-published small magazines that you could order directly from the publisher. That was zines.
Right.
And so I was doing that, and I had an imprint called Media Queen. And so this gentleman, Paul Woods from UK, writes to me and says, I want to become a publisher and I want to publish your stuff that you publish under Media Queen. And I want to call it Knocking on Joe, Voices from Death Row, because there's a Nick Cave song about it. And I'm like, well, whatever. So that was the book. That was how it got published. It got published in England in very small circulation, but it made a big impact because in England, no one's allowed to talk to prisoners.
Interesting.
This book was full of all this inside baseball, you know, inside American prisons. So in England, it was quite impactful.
You write about your next book, Killer Fiction, with a serial killer's actual fantasies and false confessions. Tell us about that.
Gerard John Schaefer is where I started because I knew him when I was a teenager and he was a nice boy I dated for a year. And it was 9 years later that he hit the headlines as a serial killer. It was a rogue cop practicing his homicidal impulses behind the badge. And it was in 1973 that he went to prison for life. And then the only thing that happened of interest to our story here is that we came up to 1988. We'll just have to skip a lot, folks, because we only have a little time. So up in 88, I was making a good living as a technical writer consultant, but the economy was bad. So I was looking around and they executed Bundy and all the news was about serial killers. And so I said, I knew a serial killer better than Ann Rule did. So let me just see if I can write a book about that. I thought it would just be, you know, a project, one of many projects, and I would go on other things, but it was not to be. I started out with Schaefer, and it's just that one thing led to another.
Tell us about the beginnings of the 5 years you spent with Danny Rowling. Tell us about the origins of your correspondence.
Let's see how quick I can make this transition. So I'm working with Schaefer. Along comes Bobby Lewis, who says, I have better stories than Schaefer. Publish my stories. And he said, I escaped from death row. And when they brought me back, they put me alone on death row with Ted Bundy. So I have these stories. So I'm like, oh, okay. And so I worked on stories of Bobby's for about a year or so. And then when they brought Danny Rowling in, after he'd been charged with 5 murders that he had committed in 1990, they put him with Bobby Lewis. And Bobby Lewis showed Danny Rowling the screenplay I had written about Bobby Lewis's escape from death row. It was called Redbone, and it's a great story, but I don't say so myself. But Danny Rowling saw that script, Redbone, and he said, whoever wrote this, I want them to help me write my story. And he wrote to me and asked me to help him work on his story with him.
Now, ideally, you would have wanted to visit with him personally. That didn't happen. Tell us why and how was this book written and how did you collaborate between you?
Naturally, everyone knew that we wanted visitation, so therefore that was used to manipulate Danny Rowling, the fact that that's what he wanted. And so it's a long story, quite a long story, and really beyond the scope of our few minutes together here. But the desire to visit was manipulated by the state's attorney's office, number one. Number two, Danny Rowling had a death wish. And he was guilty and he wanted to be executed and to pay for his crimes. And Danny Rowling insisted that I cooperate with him and the state's attorney's office to ensure that he be executed. Now, this is not the story you will hear about my role with Danny Rowling. You won't hear it because of certain reasons that were timely at the time. But now I can talk a little bit more about what really happened there. Our desire to visit was used to coerce confession from Danny Rowling that led to his execution. Both Danny and I were very frustrated and found it very difficult to work together. But look, unintended consequences, y'all. That's what made the story I have so rock solid, because every single thing is in writing and it's in his words. You don't have to rely on me going into a visit, not allowed a pencil, not allowed a paper, much less a tape recorder, talk to him for 8 hours and come out and try to write about it. Okay, you don't have that with this case.
Absolutely.
What you have is it had to be in his own words, and that makes it all the more authentic. The forces that were opposing Danny Rowling and myself didn't want any good at all to come out of our interaction, but their very efforts to stop it made it better.
Now, tell us about your writing coach, you as a writing coach, and how you introduced him to the world of self-expression. He had told you about his songs. He was very proud of the songs he had written. Tell us about this introduction into the world of self-expression. Why did you do this? What did you believe you might gain from this? Tell us about this project.
Okay, I had come off of, or let's say I had started with John Schaefer. John Schaefer had a degree in creative writing along with criminal justice. He wasn't as smart as me, but compared to your average prisoner, he was the regular Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very creative and prolific in expressing himself in writing. Then your Bobby Lewis, it was a high school dropout, but Mr. Personality and had a winning way with words that very fluent and easy. And then your Otis Toole, who was illiterate. And required a whole different approach. And so then came Danny Rowling. And Danny Rowling's problem was that he was psychologically in very poor condition. And he says himself he's had dozens of shrinks pawing through his mind, and they all come to different conclusions. But you can just say that he was very mentally ill. And he was a trauma veteran. He had been abused since before he was born. It's on the record, witnessed and sworn, that his father kicked that pregnant abdomen, that his father strangled that pregnant woman and threw her downstairs. So the abuse on Danny started before he was even a real baby. So he had, in sum, no self-esteem. And he didn't have enough self-esteem to express himself. And his very first record, though, he was so excited about a tape he had made with songs on it, that was in his very first introductory letter to me. I have this tape. I can't wait for you to hear it. And so that was a theme that went on and on and on. But just to say, that's how important it was to Danny, okay, that he had reached out in this way to the world to express himself, and that he wanted to share that with me immediately. So as we went along, we started working and asking him prompts and working back and forth and showing him better ways to get across things that he was trying to do interactively. There was a little sentence that I thought was kind of cute that I put excerpted for The Making of a Serial Killer, where he said, "Look, where it comes to writing, you're like a Ferrari and I'm more like a go-kart." Mm-hmm. It was funny, but that was true. But he handled it in the best way possible. And, to laugh at himself and to continue to improve. It was like bringing water for the first time to a plant that had been wrongfully thrown into the desert. And the way that he grew with his skills was just, it was gratifying to me, okay, working with him. But it was also quite astonishing. I mean, you just really wouldn't believe the human creature would be capable. When I first started with him, he could barely write a letter. And by the time we got to the point about 4.5 years later, where he wrote his confessions, the murder confessions, he wrote 23-page documents that didn't require a single change in a comma, a phrase, nothing.
Wow.
They were published exactly as he was able to come to terms with being able to do it. Now, with his artwork, again, it was heartbreaking to see how all this talent was buried. And he'd be writing a letter along, and then he would burst into pictures, like, in a play where they burst into song.
Right.
Would burst into graphics. And to start, he's writing words, and then it's a picture and everything. And I'm like, and then he draws really good ones. And then I'm like, Danny, you are an artist. Now, what I want you to do, when you want to draw a picture, take a page all by itself, draw the picture, sign it, and date it, okay? And like a dream student, he just sucked that right up. And anyone who has anything from Danny Rowling knows that it's dated and signed. He put his initials on the bottom of every one of the 5,000 pages of letters that he sent me. Once I gave him that instruction, And then he began, because he could see himself reflected in my eyes and he could see the value there. And that gave him the confidence to go ahead and try things, and that he wouldn't dare do anything. He was like a huddled up little dry shell of a person. It's a drawing he did of a tree. Half of it is dead. The other half is haunted. And the only animation is a tiny, tiny little face about as big as a baseball at the heart of the tree. And that's how his true spirit had to hide from the constant trauma that had been visited upon him. So that was the condition he was in. And so the work that we did was able to just rehabilitate his condition in general. And of course, being incarcerated, I think, is healthy because you have a regular schedule, you have regular food, you have a place to sleep, and everything is predictable. Well, everything, of course, but you know what I mean. And so a person doesn't have to make a lot of decisions or maybe foolish decisions. And so I think I've seen a number of cases where after the person is taken into custody, after about 60 days, they're stable enough to where they can, their real personality is able to be exhibited.
Right. Tell us what the Sicarius title, where it comes from, where it's derived from, where likely Danny Rowling had read about it or heard about it.
Okay, we're talking about the Middle East now. And that area would cover many countries at this point, but broadly in the Middle East, there was a word, Sika, S-I-C-A, I would spell it in English, but it crossed both your Hebrew and your Sanskrit and various language roots. Sika means a knife, okay? It means something you stick with. Hold it in your hand and stick somebody with it. Time and time again, that was called a Sika. So were you to go on Google and search the word Sika, the pictures that would come up would look different. But that merely speaks to how broad this phenomenon was, that you look different in different times and places, but they are Sika. So here's how this came down. This was when the Romans conquered the Jews, and they occupied Jerusalem, okay? Many of the Jews fought this occupation, and they were called zealots. They were very zealous about fighting to keep Jerusalem Jewish. The Sicarii were the first cloak and dagger assassins. They wore a cloak, and they carried a sika, and they a Sicarius would go into the marketplace, a crowded venue, maybe in the temple, where there are many people bustling up against one another, and pull that little dagger out and stab the victim, and then throw their hands up, pretend to be scared and run away. Everybody runs away, and it's all confusing, and they never get caught. The thing that made them different from zealots was the Sicarii there at Masada were killing collaborators. Okay, they were killing the Jews who were going along with the occupation. So that's what differentiated them from the zealots. Today we hear the word Sicario used in pop culture, because it's used in Latin America, and it means the same thing, an assassin, a stabber. Now, where did Danny Rowling get the idea of Sicarii in the first place? Kind of an exotic word. Well, we will point out that Paul the Apostle mentioned the Sicarii in the book of Acts. So it's quite possible that that's where he first heard the word.
Now, you talk about Sicarius when you were his writing coach and his editor and encouraging his artwork and the inclusion of that in this story. Did he tell you why he chose the title Sicarius?
No, he never did. He just wrote to me, this is something I'm starting to write now, called Sicarius. And I didn't know what it meant. I had to look it up.
So tell us more about this process of encouragement and this writing coach and the development of this story.
Okay. So you remember we were working together, collaborating by correspondence in order to do this book. I was sued before the book was written so that the state could threaten me to stop, don't do this. And as I pointed out to them, I'm not doing this for the money. I'm doing this because you're telling me not to, and I'm not going to allow you to do that. That this is my project. And they said that they were going to seize my profits before it was even written.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's not lawful. You might be aware of that, but that was what was done. So we proceed working on in that manner, disregarding all the difficulties that were being put upon us in that way. Meanwhile, Danny Rowland continued to petition for visitation. And we continued to go through an elaborate rigmarole every time with new made-up rules and new made-up reasons and all that. At one point, they said that, okay, we were friends, but our friendship was not leading to marriage. So that's why they would refuse us visitation. So we consulted among ourselves and said, okay, it leads to marriage. And then they had another new rule, right? It never ended. During the time I was working with him, he became very wise about what I meant about an exclusive story. He saw all the suffering I was going through because I was working with him, and he became more and more compassionate of my position and very, very protective of his own story in order to keep our project going, and because it had to be exclusive. And that put him in another kind of isolation because he was by me. He was for correspond with anyone. And once we got the confessions written, once we got the Making of a Serial Killer published, then there came a day where the warden came to Danny Rowland's cell, which is very, very rare, but he did, and told him he might as well give it up because he was never going to see me. And at that point, Danny Rowland conceded the battle and said he was going to have to just give this up, this exclusive arrangement. So at that point, we both said, okay, you can write to anyone. You can do anything you want. You're free. No obligation to me. He still had an obligation to me regarding the murder confessions up in Louisiana, which he respected until the moment of his execution. He gave me those confessions and he would not give them to anyone else, although he did, for the record, admit his guilt. But he did not give the full 23-page account of what happened there and what went on in his mind. I still have that. He gave it to me. Okay. So he had a complete respect for our relationship, but he was corresponding with other people. So then during that period was when he wrote to me about Sicarius and said in his letter, when I get done, I'll send it to you. But because of the pressures going on behind bars, and we have no idea what that's like, you know, living at the pleasure of sadists in power and things you can't say, there are things you can't say. So one thing and another happened, and the manuscript wound up in the hands of an individual who's well known to be of low character. His name is Ken Carnig, and I'm not going to say anything libelous. It's all true story. He had that manuscript to Sicarius on his website for sale for $5,000 for years.
Wow.
And I don't know what happened to that manuscript. And Ben Carnegie is the same individual who put out a story that Danny Rowland was gay and that he had love letters from Danny Rowland to this other inmate. This was not true. And I had the classification officer in charge of the whole affair confirmed to me that this alleged gay lover of his had never even been on the same wing as Danny Rowland. But Ken Carnig was running up and down the world telling everyone Danny Rowland was gay. And so at that time, when that was going on, I'm going to read you what Danny Rowland had to say about Ken Carnig.
Yes.
Ken Carnig said, Danny, on right the day after Christmas in 1996, can give himself a hydrochloric acid enema for all I care. That lying piece of gutter slime, I wouldn't dirty a blade on him. The only reason that punk runs his mouth is because he can feel secure that I'm page on Florida's death row, coward lowlife. If I could get my hands on him, I'd beat him to death. Okay, so that's how Danny Rowling felt about the person who held this book, prevented it from reaching our listeners and our readers. That was Ken Carnick. So somehow or another, the book's contents wound up with a man who did special effects makeup out of Canada. He published it and then a very, very, very small circulation and then died. And then so as I was moving around the world, I kept asking these collectors and fans, anyone know whatever happened to that book, Sicarius? And all through the years, everyone said they didn't know, but they were looking for it too. So it just became up to a gentleman by the name of Wade Gardner, who was kind enough to send me his very, very, very rare book. So that enabled me to bring this to print at last.
You say there was considerable work that you had to do, and you talk about that incredible work and using software and restoring the art and the original text. Daunting project that you had.
It was this book crudely printed on paper that had yellowed and the print had, you know, faded to gray. So it was sort of between the orange page and the gray print. And the artwork was degraded. But fortunately, Wade had his hands on the original artwork. And he provided me with high resolution scans to use for the book instead of scanning the way it was printed in that tiny little paperback book. I was able to get good, strong images. And then I also included in this book that I put out 50 or more other images from my collection of Danny Rowling's artwork. They were not in the original.
You write that this book is offered for you to use as you have, for others to use as you have, as a glass to peer into the mind of the homicidal maniac who brought it forth by hand, word from a dungeon at the dead end of Murder Road. And you say, although the genre is fiction, its provenance is all too real.
Yes. Well, I'd like to analyze that, basing my analysis on a commonplace observation by Sigmund Freud that he relied on when he did his psychoanalysis of dreams. According to Freud, it was productive for him and his patients to go over their dreams and think about every person that was in the dream is some part of their own self. So I wanted to take that approach when looking at the characters that were brought forth in this fiction by Danny Rowling. And we can also look at even current day psychological practice treating children with sandbox therapy, where you put the child at a sandbox with an infinite array of little figures and toys, and the therapist just kind of watches as the child makes up dramas with the figures and acts them out. Because there's more to telling the truth than just words. And I don't believe that you can do anything without revealing who you are. Every gesture. That's why we have graphoanalysis, to look at your handwriting and go from that to who you are. And you know, it can be a nonsense, but you know, there are also corporations who employ graphoanalysis for applicants. So it is not at all invalid to take this approach. In literature, we have a thing called a fallacy, which means it's like a pitfall you could fall into, called the intentional fallacy, where the earnest student of literature is not to try to plumb the intentions of the author, but to allow the work to stand on its own two legs and leave the author out of it. Because I think they come up with that fallacy because I think it's only natural to look at a work of art and to wonder what in the world was the artist thinking when they did that. But we're cautioned as students of literature not to practice that because it's a fallacy. So let me explain to your audience that I'm aware of that. And now we're going to do it anyway, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
I think it's useful. And the other reason this is very useful is because Danny Rowling literally had multiple personalities. And you can quibble over that on your own time. You didn't have to deal with him day after day, year after year. And a person who really has multiple personalities is just a part of them. And Danny Rowling did. So there. So when we come to the characters that he lays out here, I can explain to you how each character would exemplify an aspect of Danny Rowling in a way that helps us understand him and the terrible loss of control that ruined so many lives that he experienced. Just to start with this analysis, I want to go into the very idea of knife crime, the Dagger Man. Why did he choose to title it and to focus it on the use of that particular weapon, the knife? Okay. So if it was just about murder, just about anything would do so long as the target was rendered dead, right? But no, there's something about a knife for Danny Rowling. And I find myself once again quoting from what he wrote for me in The Making of a Serial Killer. And it's so poignant. I just really want to share it with you. Danny says, I'll say this much. Once a knife's blade has tasted human flesh, it becomes transformed from mere metal and leather to an entity which thirsts for more and more blood. In fact, it even smells different, sweeter. The sickening sweet smell of power to take life poured out on its tempered edge.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor. Have you thought about seeing a therapist or a psychiatrist, but you've got a busy schedule and you don't know exactly how to get the whole process started? Try Talkspace. By conducting everything involved online, Talkspace makes getting the help you need easy, convenient, and affordable. But don't wait until something bad happens before you decide to get a therapist's help. At Talkspace.com, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. It's incredibly convenient to have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. Talkspace can help with any specific challenges you might be facing. It's the number one online therapy platform with licensed therapists in over 40 specialties, including anxiety, depression, substance abuse, relationship issues, and more. Talkspace is affordable and in-network with most major insurers. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/truemurder. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/truemurder to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/truemurder. You just quoted from Danny Rowling and the power and the importance of the knife in this Sicarius story and in his crimes. And we were talking about his dissociative identity personality disorder and these fragmented character of Danny Rowling at the time that you had met him and all of the characters that you said you experienced in this 5 years of collaboration with Danny Rowling. Tell us about the basic premise of this plot and some of the characters that he introduces.
Okay. Well, the camera, if you will, and the first person speaking is a character that he calls Sir Windsor Ashmole the Third. And, he's a little bit like Dickens in that the names he chooses allude to certain qualities. This one alludes to a higher class. First of all, he's a sir, so that's something. But Windsor, he spells it W-I-N-S-E-R. I know that he knows it's Windsors, the Royal Windsors is W-I-N-D, but
sure.
He spells it Windsor. So that brings in the association to wincing, mincing. Okay, so he is a proper person with a secure position, a good education. Okay, very privileged. But essentially, he's a moral person who's trying to do the right thing. Now, if we compare that to Danny Rowling, of course, he's not privileged. But he was capable of the kind of scholarly introspection that is required to write a book.
Right.
Because after all, he did. And so in that sense, he had become stable enough within himself that he could be familiar with that kind of personality within himself. Someone who could be a reliable narrator and carry the plot forward. Okay, so that's, I'm not saying that's the Danny Rowling who cut a girl's head off. Do you understand?
Right.
Okay, certainly. That in this disorder, those different personalities do not blend, do not mix, do not know each other, and frankly, don't like each other. So try to remember that. So this character is our main character. He's the pivotal point telling the story. But it's a good thing he's a little dull because that puts more contrast on the main character, the real interest. And he starts out as introduced as a Dr. Borgum Conoff. What kind of name is that? No one's ever been named that. What does that remind me of? Boris Karloff.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I'm thinking Danny's reaching around for a sound that's going to sound kind of like a big monster guy. And he comes up with this Dr. Borgum Conoff. Okay. So this is a really the criminal side of Danny Rowling. I don't mean the murderer, but the robber, the gunslinger running around, taking all kind of crazy risks and on his motorcycle and all that kind of stuff. And that would be the other side of Danny's personality that would be Borgum Conoff. But there's more to Borgum Conoff because he is a multiple personality, you see, in the book. He is going mad. When we start the book, he's right on the edge of losing it. Okay, he's been torturing girls and he's getting caught and he isn't handling it well and he's misbehaving. And then he jumps on a plane and escapes from Mauritius, the island kingdom, and goes to America. And by the time he gets to America, he's no longer Borgum Conoff. He's Dr. Victor Grigory, and he also is a phony, and he pretends to be respectable, veterinarian, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he uses that social credit to get by, which has come to America. Now, compare that to what Danny Rowling did by robbing grocery stores and banks, filling his pockets with a lot of cash. He was playing the freewheeling tourist in Sarasota, Florida, with a new identity and passing himself off as a respectable person. So that is really what this Grigory is, still the same guy, remember, right?
Right.
He's known as Grigory, Dr. Grigory. That's what he was doing in America. He's passing himself off. Now, you look at the mythological, fantastical, science fiction level, supernatural abilities that emerge from him is Sicarius. Okay, so Sicarius is like a spirit that comes out of Dr. Conoff, Grigory, that character, all right? And in so doing, you compare that to Danny Rowling housing a murder demon that he called Gemini.
Yes.
Now, in the book, Sicarius, the supernatural spirit, has some very flashy powers that he uses. In the true story of Danny Rowling, Gemini, he attributed powers to Gemini that were very trivial. And the example is when he went to the first door in Gainesville and tried to open it, it didn't open. And so he prayed to Gemini and said, okay, Gemini, if you really want me to do this, then open this door. So then when he tried it again, it came right open. So he said, well, that proves it. See, that's the way the psychotic mind will work. But at any rate, that was how Danny thought of Gemini. And he felt that Gemini was some alien spirit that took advantage of his broken mind to invade and to will his puppet flesh to do evil things. Okay, so it was out of his control. Now, I mentioned earlier that flashy aspect, high-risk aspect, that was he called Enad. Enad is the word Danny backwards.
Yes.
Okay? But he distinguishes. Enad is a pretty rough guy. Enad is the guy who knew how to do time, quite frankly. Little Danny was not the kind of person who could handle being in jail. Little Danny is curled up somewhere, completely silent inside. And Enad walks the yard like a man. Okay, so that's Enad. But Gemini, he has an uneasy relationship with. So that's the comparison I make to the character that from which the murder demon Sicarius emerges in a similar way. Okay.
In Sicarius, there are elements of Frankenstein, it seems, with the electrodes attached to the women's temples.
Yeah.
To create this different character.
Yeah.
But throughout this entire story, seems like a decent writer, a very good writer, but the immaturity of the sexual relations in the book
is noticeable.
Yes, and it does demonstrate something about Danny Rowling and how he views women, especially because he has all the freedom in the world to write about them any way he wants.
Yeah, because I gave him that freedom, and so that's why. And so that's the only way you're going to find out what's in there. You can't be standing there wagging your finger. Oh, no, no, that's naughty. You can't say that. You know, you have to say, I respect your standing as someone who's committed heinous, horrible crimes people can't even imagine. And you are sitting there facing your execution for this. You are sitting on death row in the worst neighborhood in the world. Everybody around you is crazy and homicidal. And there you are. I respect that.
But what I'm saying is that it's very interesting that how his attitudes towards women, ultimately this murderer of women, revealing his attitudes in this book and the absolute immaturity that he has about sexual relations itself. He's talking like he had only read Penthouse Forum back in the day, and that's how he understands the relationship with a woman.
Yes, but it wasn't just women. Going back to making him a serial killer, he relates how he thought maybe joining organized crime would be a good idea at one point. And that was just a carnival. It was just a clown show, the episode where he tried to get in with the mafia and really fell on his butt like a bozo, and he reveals that he just didn't know how to act.
You write about some of the things that he had said later, Danny Rowling had said about his experience as a killer. There was some controversy and about whether he had accidentally killed Krista Hoyt or that it was a lucky cut, but he explains exactly what that was about.
Oh, those experts really were in a tizzy over this case, and there were a lot of careers that were ruined because it was Keystone Cops from the very beginning. Danny Rowling stood up in the middle of broad daylight, stripped his shirt off, took a big honking pistol, and ran to a bank screaming, everybody get down, vaulting over the counter, smashing the camera with his gun. Give me all your money, he yells, okay, making a huge spectacle of himself as a gunman robbing a bank. And then that very same night, the very same guy is creeping around in the dark with a knife, committing sex crimes against females who are at home in bed. Now, the science of profiling might as well just go home and take a nap. because they cannot make head nor tails out of that, you see? Mm. And the reason is because he's multiple personality. That was a different personality who committed those two very, very different types of crimes.
You write in this book that he was raised with some type of religious background, but sense of that, and he was religious at for a time anyway. And throughout this story, there is this, again, struggle between good and evil. He still has that within his mindset, doesn't he?
He was very religious and up until his death. When he died, he was singing a song of thanks and praise, none greater than thee, O Lord. Okay. Mm-hmm. His religion was never far from his very, very deep commitment. And I think I go into his analysis of the figures in the book when I talk about the law enforcement figures, because we find out that he, Danny Rowling, is in the center of Danny Rowling. He has a respect for the law and a respect for the proper behavior and for honorable behavior. He has created a character, the FBI special agent, that he is the ultimate good guy cop. And then you have a couple of other policemen in there that are, for comic relief, they're idiots, fools. And then you have a bureaucrat cop that, you know, sits on the top and doesn't do anything. But in all those police, you never have a James Harold Rowling, the giant with the big stick. The making of the serial killer. There is no character like that among the law enforcement officers, okay? Which is really noticeable with the dog that didn't bark. And if you take those in the conglomerate of all of his characterizations of those who are in law enforcement, you would find that part of Danny who would have been just delighted to have been a cop, to enforce the law, to be responsible for correcting people when they committed these crimes. Remember, he came to me wanting to be killed for what he'd done. He did not come to me proud of it or happy about the situation. He was very, very religious, and it was not opposed. It was the central...
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue... panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy. And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Fact of his life. But if there is if this troubles the listener, to try to wrap their mind around the evil behavior along with the worship of godly qualities, I would have to direct them to Romans 7. And I'm not going to sit here and quote scripture, but in Romans 7, which is something Danny Rowling drew my attention to, the sinner, the bad guy, bemoans the fact that he loves the law. He loves God. And that's what he wants to do. And yet his behavior is bad. And that is the peculiar situation of the sinner that believes in righteousness, but finds himself the one doing unrighteousness. Okay, that is Danny Rowling's existential conundrum.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
You talked about this respect that throughout the story, it seems, for law enforcement, but also that we didn't mention that his father was a police officer and he was traumatized by an event that even though he was attacked in, as a child, later as an adult, he cites a particularly traumatic event where his father in a squad car in uniform, he was sleeping and he came into his house and gave him a savage beating, which he
jumped on him. Danny was sound asleep in bed. With a knife, jumped on him, put a knife to his throat.
Yeah. But despite all of this, he still said that he loved his father, that there still was that, despite this trauma, despite nothing but horrible childhood memories, he still loved his father. So this respect for law enforcement seems to be stemming from that.
That's why he was a divided person. That's why he was not well mentally, okay? The people that you meet, and most of you will never meet anyone whose personality is completely divided. Most of you will never meet anyone. But if you do, you only meet one part of them anyway. So you'll go your way and you'll never know the difference. It takes prolonged exposure to a person to really realize how profound this condition is. And fortunately, it's very rare. But you jump to the part where James Harold attacked him with a knife. But I wanted, if you don't mind, delve into the precursor to that.
Yes.
Because there is a concept that everyone should study up on called epigenetics. Epigenetics. We know how our DNA carries traits from one generation to another. Epigenetics is the new twist on that, where we're learning how the events of our lives change the messaging that's carried by that DNA. And when the child inherits that DNA, they're inheriting messages that came through the life experience of their sire, okay? So we have to go back to Danny Rowling's sire. His name was James Harold, okay? James Harold Rowling. When he was a little boy sitting at the dinner table with his family, his grandfather got up and cut his grandmother's throat right there at the table.
Yes.
And killed her right in front of the family. Now, listen, when someone does something like that, they are not just committing murder. They're not just ending the life of the victim. They are transmitting a message, okay? They are using that knife to cause fear. Okay, that is terrorism. That's what we call terrorism, causing fear. So this is how the knife is used in Danny's DNA messaging, okay? Because James Harold never let the family forget it. James Harold would take out his gun and wave it and say, I'm going to get you. Or he'd take that knife and he'd flip the blade out and he'd slide it down. And he'd say, I somebody open, just like that. This is the way he talked to his family. He used the knife and would constantly remind them about how his grandfather cut his grandmother's throat and went to prison for the rest of his life. Okay, so those are as deep, as traumatic, and as significant as they can be when it comes to the knife man, the Sicarius. After all his life of crime and all the things he did, the term is Sicarius. It's about the knife.
Yes. It's interesting, the character, the servant girl, and this plot theme about pituitary gland seems smacks of Bathory and supposed motive that, again, she was killing young servant girls to gain immortality.
To recapture the youth she saw slipping away.
But also the name of that one woman, that servant girl, was Sika, which has a reference to Sicarius and the knife as well.
Yeah, it's full of little Easter eggs like that. But if you don't mind, I'll deliver a little bit of a spoiler because it's interesting and people may not want to read the book, but they may want to think about this.
Absolutely.
At the very end of the book, I talk about the characters and I mention that they're all fictional, okay? The only character in here who's real is a woman named Kath. And Kath really was Danny Rowling's girlfriend, and she really was a satanic witch. And that was what she called herself, and that is how she presented herself, and that is how Danny Rowling saw her, as a satanic witch, okay? So I know that one of the most profound parts of Danny was his spiritual commitment to his Lord and Savior, and that he knew he was facing the end of his natural life, and that he told me many times that he wanted to clear the slate. He didn't want to go to his maker without confessing to everything he had done. Now, when I read this book and I see what this character that is one of his surrogates has done in the pages of this fictional scenario he contrived, it makes me wonder if Danny Rowling has found a way to put that confession on the record in the way that it is encrypted as fiction. I knew the young lady, Kath, and we talked on the phone and we corresponded. I never met her in person, but there was one occasion where Kath told me that Danny Rowling had not told me everything that happened at the Krista Hoyt murder scene and that it was much worse. She said it went much further. And I just took her comment. I did not probe, and she never said another thing. Miss Kath disappeared off of the internet after her work was done, and I have not heard from her since then. And I wish that she would contact me and see if she would share with me what Danny told her. But here's the suspicion I put in the pages of this book in my reflections. Danny Rowling was afraid to tell me that he had eaten human flesh because he was afraid that I could not tolerate it and would abandon him. And my company was the gift that I brought him.
Right.
So now I wonder that when he had a companion who was admittedly a satanic witch who held rituals invoking the presence of Lucifer, that maybe that made him believe that she would still accept him if she knew he had eaten human flesh. So I opened the door on the very last page to wondering what really happened to the pituitary gland of Krista Hoyt. And guess what? It's going to be an unsolved mystery because that autopsy is sealed.
Wow.
I called his lawyer and told her I just really wanted to know if I could find out if her pituitary was intact. And she said it could not be done, that the autopsy was sealed.
Fascinating. I want to thank you, Sandra London, for coming on and talking about Sicarius. Sandra London presents Death Row Fiction by a Serial Killer. Tell us about any social media you do, and if you have a website, tell us how people might find out more about books that you have written and this book in particular.
I wish everybody would go to my website, and that is sandralondon.com. S-O-N-D-R-A-L-O-N-D-O-N, sandralondon.com. I have so much content on there that you can read. And on each one of those items that concerns one of my books, you will find a link that says, buy this book. And then that will take you to Amazon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Sandra London. Sicarius. Sandra London presents Death Row Fiction by a Serial Killer. Thank you so much for this interview. It's been a fascinating time speaking with you. Thank you so much for this interview.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
And good night.